There are some military groupings which are also involved in or implicated in human rights violations.
We're going to have to leave it there, but of course we'll continue to follow all of these issues. Niels Muižnieks is the Council of Europe Commissioner for Human Rights. And that does it for our show, though this news just in, Democratic presidential candidate Lincoln Chafee has dropped out of the race for the Democratic Party nomination for president. Chafee's a Republican turned independent turned Democratic former governor and senator of Rhode Island. We have a job opening at Democracy Now! It's development director, full-time in New York. Go to our website to find out the details at democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Carla Wills, Dina Guzder, Amy Littlefield, Nermeen Sheikh, Sam Alkoff, Robbie Karen, Steve Martinez, Hani Massoud, Juan Carlos Davila, and Pedro Rodriguez. Mike DeFilippo, Miguel Noguera, our engineer. Special thanks to Becca Staley, Julie Crosby. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
KBOO Portland. The time is 5 p.m. Coming up next is the KBOO Evening News.
Start your Saturday morning with a little swingin' country. The KBOO Swingin' Country program will be broadcasting live from the Tin Shed Garden Cafe on Saturday, October 24th from 7 a.m. to 9 a.m. I know you've been hankering to put a face to those velvety tones, so here's your chance. You are welcome to come early, pull up a chair, and enjoy some coffee, food, and an earful of swinging country. The Tin Shed Garden Cafe is located at 1438 Northeast Alberta Street in the City of Roses. Again, that's swinging country live from the Tin Shed, Saturday, October 24th, here at your community radio station, KBOO Portland.
October is Filipino-American History Month to honor the moment in history when the first documented Filipinos on a Spanish galleon arrived in Morro Bay, California in October, 428 years ago. Tune in Friday night, October 23rd from 6 p.m. to midnight as KBOO airs music, interviews, and live programming that give voice to largely untold stories of Filipino-Americans who have shaped American culture and the course of history. We'll hear from legends such as Joe Bataan and Fanny, as well as hip-hop artists like Bamboo and Rocky Rivera. That's Friday night, October 23rd, starting 6 p.m. to midnight at your community radio station, KBOO Portland.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, the new homeless encampment on Greeley Avenue has received support from the city.
The biggest hurricane to ever hit...
The biggest hurricane to ever hit Mexico is on its way to the western coast this evening.
We'll hear from activists fighting the planned natural gas pipeline in Oregon.
Good evening. Good evening, this is the KBOO Evening News for Friday, October 23rd, 2015. I'm Callie Mikhail.
And I'm Liam Delta. It looks like Portland will have another established homeless encampment, this time on the east side of the river. Hazelnut Grove is the unofficial name of a campsite off North Greeley and Interstate Avenues. The camp has moved from an ad hoc collection of tents to a campsite with possible toilet and garbage pickup provided by the city. Before the city agreed to provide support, campers were swept several times off sections of the land owned by the Department of Transportation and Union Pacific Railway. The Overlook Neighborhood Association also wrote an angry letter to the office of Mayor Hales. However, support from local homeless advocates seems to have helped soften the surrounding community's reaction to a permanent campsite and created a more organized structure within the camp. The campers recently created a code of conduct in response to the neighborhood's concern with safety. Homeless advocate Vahid Brown speculates that the city hasn't issued a sweep of the publicly owned land, parts of the land. The city has not issued a sweep of the publicly owned parts of the land in order to avoid bad publicity in the wake of the housing state of emergency. He spoke this morning on KBOO's talk radio program about the state of emergency and the people camping at Greeley.
You know, we have far more homeless than we have shelters. We have far too few affordable housing units. As you know, this is a problem that extends. You know, it starts with the inflation of property values, right? With all the folks moving into Portland, all of the speculation, the real estate speculation. It starts at that end with the wealthy developers tearing down old homes so they can build, you know, high-end condos. The folks at Greeley are on the bottom end of that chain of causal events. So this isn't, this involves all of us. This is the folks that are living outside are sort of the front line on our housing crisis. So our rent increases, I'm a renter, are pushing people with fewer resources than us who are being squeezed by these rent increases into the streets. And so some of the folks that I know at Greeley have, you know, are in a situation where they have incomes, they can't afford a rent, they're on a list to get housing, and they've been told that they're going to be on that list for 4 to 6 months. So they have nowhere to go. They don't have an alternative to sleeping outside.
The Black Cauldron Strip Club is getting a makeover. The club at 16015 Southeast Stark will become a homeless shelter that will eventually house up to 130 people. The building will be bought by the Multnomah County Board of Commissioners with the help of a $300,000 loan. K2 reports that the shelter will be operated for at least 6 years, 24 hours a day, by the Portland-based nonprofit Human Solutions. Renovations are expected to be finished by February at a cost of nearly $400,000.
Portland has become known around the country as a city for so-called foodies, and that reputation is warranted according to a new report by Portland State University and the City of Portland. The researchers found that the Portland area food economy adds over $22 billion to Oregon's economy, and that number is quickly growing. The report found that 12% of jobs in the Portland area are from the food economy. This includes restaurants, grocery stores, and certain food manufacturing, including coffee roasting. In the Portland area, jobs in the food economy increased by 7% in a recent two-year period, while job growth in other sectors was just over 4%. The city's urban renewal areas, food economy jobs, are growing at an extremely fast rate. The largest number of food economy jobs are found in the Interstate Corridor area, while the largest number of food processing and distribution jobs are on the Central East Side. These are two areas that have been identified by housing advocates as places where gentrification is playing a major role in displacing low-income and minority residents. The city says they hope this study of the local food economy will contribute to other local efforts to address the impact of climate change.
Police arrested 34 men and women in Clackamas County on Wednesday during a countrywide sweep targeting domestic violence offenders. The suspects were put into the Clackamas and Multnomah County jails on charges including assault, harassment, and strangulation. The domestic violence warrant sweep was started 13 years ago by Clackamas County Sheriff Craig Roberts. Since then, 36 states have joined the campaign, which has resulted in over 11,000 arrests. According to statistics from the Federal Bureau of Justice, one in every four women will experience domestic violence in her lifetime. Domestic abuse severely affects children, making them more likely to attempt suicide, abuse drugs and alcohol, run away from home, and fall into teenage prostitution. Nate Thompson with Clackamas County Sheriff's Office said that on this night of the sweep, the victim can sleep and rest easy because that person that's been victimizing them is in jail. There are resources in Oregon and Washington for victims of domestic violence. Some of these include the Oregon Domestic Violence Resource Center in Hillsborough, which you can contact at 503-640-5352, extension 302. The Portland Women Crisis Line, 503 205-235-5333, and the Gateway Center on East Burnside Street at 503-988-6400.
A suit filed by the state of Oregon against dietary supplement retailer GNC yesterday caused the company's stock to tumble to a 52-week low. The state's attorney general alleges that GNC knowingly sold numerous products containing the supplements picamelon and BMPEA. Picamelon, a synthetic drug, was designed and developed by researchers in the former Soviet Union and has never been approved for use in the U.S. The FDA considers it unsafe. BMPEA, first created in the 1930s, is similar in structure to amphetamines. According to the suit, it has never gone through clinical trials on humans or been declared safe for human consumption. Effects of the drugs include elevated blood pressure, severe enough to potentially induce cardiac arrest. Hundreds of people are sent to emergency rooms every year after having ingested the substance. Oregon Attorney General Ellen Rosenblum accuses GNC of selling products that contain an ingredient that is not approved for sale in this country and is not labeled as an ingredient. According to the suit, GNC Vice President David Sullivan knew about the illegal contents and chose to keep them on the shelves.
Stopping LNG projects in Oregon was the subject of a panel discussion yesterday evening before a packed room at the First Unitarian Church in downtown Portland. Two proposed liquefied natural gas LNG export terminals, the Jordan Cove project in Coos Bay and Oregon LNG in Warrenton, are currently moving through the regulatory process. An Oregon-wide Stop LNG coalition has been formed, and they've helped organize call-in days to Governor Brown, an action camp last weekend in Eugene, and last night's panel, among other initiatives. A wide range of speakers spoke on the panel, including Dan Saris of Columbia Riverkeeper, Pamela Ordway, a landowner whose property would be impacted by the Jordan Cove pipeline, and Alex Harris, who organized a 232-mile resistance hike this summer along the proposed route of the pipeline called Hike the Pipe.
There's been this huge movement around stopping coal exports, a huge movement around dealing with these explosive oil trains. What we need now is for everyone here to commit to being involved in the fight against liquefied natural gas exports. It's the only way we're going to stop this. These guys are still touting themselves as a climate benefit. Our previous governor, John Kitzhaber, said, we think there are big climate benefits with doing LNG versus coal. We know that that's a scientific fiction. We can prove it. And it's time to call Governor Brown out on it. LNG has been touted as this bridge fuel, as a way to get off of coal. What's really, really important is to know that that's an absolute fiction. We've learned a lot in the last 5 years about how damaging natural gas production, transmission, and liquefaction can be. What we've learned is that the leakage of methane is such a powerful part of this process that it completely eliminates any advantage that natural gas would have over coal. Dmitry Lisitsyn is an activist from Sakhalin Island, Russia, and he spoke here in the Unitarian Church in 2008. And his message then, and they were dealing with an LNG export terminal from Sakhalin Island, was don't let them start, don't let them build it. Once they start, you won't be able to stop them, and they'll do this kind of damage to your salmon rivers. So they would be remodeling these estuaries, these critical salmon estuaries. In Coos Bay, this would be the largest single-purpose dredging project in Oregon's history. So we're not talking about channel deepening. We're talking about for a single purpose, a single terminal. This would be the biggest one ever. Absolutely enormous. This is the worst project Oregon has ever seen. It would do more damage to this estuary than anything we've ever seen. The pipelines would cross more streams and rivers than almost anything ever we've ever seen. Maybe the I-5 rivals it. You know, and these are the stakes. And you add to that the enormous climate change impact, and you can see why there's such a movement congealing around this.
We're committed to managing our land to the best of our abilities and passing it on to future generations in the hopes that they'll pass it on to theirs. But the threat of this pipeline has us in a holding pattern. We're not moving forward with any of our plans because we just don't know what the future holds. And it's been like this for a long time. The nightmare began in December 2007 when Jordan Cove first applied to FERC for approval to import liquefied natural gas. As U.S. production ballooned, importing LNG began to make little sense, and we all breathed a collective sigh of relief, but for a very short while, because almost immediately Jordan Cove applied to change the purpose from import to export. So for those of us who line the path of the proposed pipeline, it's been almost 8 years of upheaval. We defer plans to make improvements. We spend countless hours attending planning and county commissioner meetings, writing letters to elected officials and editors of newspapers. We donate money to organizations fighting against the Jordan Cove project. And in our case, we banded together with other landowners, spending money we could ill afford in order to mount a legal battle to fight blatantly unfair land use decisions. If allowed, the pipeline will go past their barns and their homes, tearing up orchards that have been nurtured for years, threatening wells that supply their drinking water, and forest land held in trust for a rainy day. It'll leave an ugly scar in its wake because vegetation removed won't be allowed to grow back. Our neighbor to the east moved into her farm as a teenage bride in the early 1950s. And has been there ever since. She tells me she can't sleep at night. She worries what will happen if the pipeline goes through. The current path puts the pipeline about 75 yards from her house. And she's seen the pictures. She's heard the stories. She knows if the pipeline is put in and there's an explosion, she's a statistic. And it's not the only threat keeping her up at night. The letters and phone calls we've all gotten have been incessant and intimidating. Offers for easement rights delivered to us clearly state that if FERC approves their proposals, they have the right to take our land through the eminent domain process, whether we want it or not. All of us along the pipeline received multiple letters from a law firm specializing in eminent domain and touting their close working relationship with the company that's proposing to build the pipeline. And if the letters aren't intimidating enough, the law firms have been calling landowners along the pipeline, too, acting as if the project has been approved and the pipeline's a done deal. Of course, we can all not answer the phone, toss the letters, take a walk in the woods to blow off steam, and that's when it gets even more disturbing. Stakes with orange flags magically appear, along with mystical spray-painted markings on trees and rocks. Feels like you've been kicked in the stomach. Something you don't want and are using all your resources to fight against seems to be steadily, unrelentingly creeping into your private world.
Unfortunately, the government, even though they're taking private and public land, is not publicizing what land they're taking. So they've released a draft environmental impact statement and now a final environmental impact statement for the Jordan Cove Energy Project. But in that impact statement, all they give you is small snapshots, small maps of 10 or 15 square miles at a time. Each map is always oriented differently, north-south. So you flip to, from page to page, and even if you know the territory, for instance, I would flip and look at the place that I grew up just outside of Ashland. I couldn't recognize it. And I said, you know, this is a problem. We don't even know where this pipeline is. So what we did is with each of those maps, we generated landmarks, and we put those landmarks onto a broader map. We generated hundreds of dots. We connected those dots. We generated the pipeline. We overlay taxing lot information. Then we found out who the landowners were. And then all of a sudden, we had infrastructure to do something about this, connecting people. And when you connect people, crazy stuff happens. It's amazing. We sent out a letter to these individuals, these landowners who were impacted. And for most of them, they had never even heard from anybody opposing the Jordan Cove Energy Project. The only letters that they had received were from corporations. And in those letters, it talks about eminent domain, and it talks with all this legal language, and people feel like, oh, am I being sued? Did I do something wrong? They don't know how to navigate. So for them to see our letter telling them, no, just so you know, in fact, most people haven't signed, so don't let them lie to you. You don't have to sign. This doesn't have to happen. It was a morale booster for these people, and they were able to see an outlet to oppose and reject this project.
Those were the voices of people fighting the proposed LNG pipeline in Oregon, recorded last night by KBOO's Paul Rowland. It's 5:18, time for daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
and did not expect this. The National Republican Party has published an official policy document showing that the GOP really might be more than a gaggle of serve-the-rich plutocrats and wacky, trumped-up right-wingers. Just when you thought the party was consuming itself in the know-nothingism of its presidential pretenders and the recalcitrant do-nothingism of its Congress critters, out comes a sign of sanity. In this 18-page manifesto, the party proclaims that, quote, our government was created by the people for all the people, and it must serve no less a purpose. All the people. Forget pontifications by Wall Street billionaires dividing America into virtuous creators, like themselves, and worthless moochers, like you and me. This document abounds with commitments to the common good. Quote, America does not prosper, it proudly proclaims on page 3, unless all Americans prosper. Wow, that's downright democratic. And how's this for a complete turnaround? Labor is the United States. The men and women who, with their minds, their hearts, and hands, create the wealth that is shared in this country, they are America. Holy Koch brothers, share the wealth? Yes, and how about this? The protection of the right of workers to organize into unions and to bargain collectively is the firm and permanent policy of the Republican Party. Eat your heart out, Scott Walker, and you other labor-bashing GOP governors. The document also supports our public postal service, the United Nations, equal rights for women, expanding our national parks, vigorous enforcement of antitrust laws, and raising the minimum wage. New enlightenment in the grand old party. Hallelujah! This is Jim Hightower saying, can all this be true? Believe it or not, yes it is, except it's not new. This document is the Republican Party platform of 1956.
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's populist take on what the powers that be are up to. Find out more at hightowerlowdown.org.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for media analysis from Counterspin. This will be followed by a special program from 6 to 10 p.m. honoring Filipino-American History Month. Tomorrow's weather in the Portland area, cool and cloudy with a high of 66. It'll drop down to the 40s again tonight and tomorrow night, and Sunday night, or rather Sunday, will be rainy and cool with a high of 66. Today in history, on the 23rd of October, 1948, France moved to declare martial law to crack down on striking miners. The declaration followed the communist union leaders calling for a general strike earlier that week. The state called up 50,000 troops to go after coal miners on strike. Two miners were killed in the attack. The quote of the day is from labor leader Mother Jones. She said, "I'm not afraid of the pen or the scaffold or the sword. I will tell the truth wherever I please." A number of high-tech companies have sent a letter to legislators calling for computer science to be added to the core curriculum for K through 12 students. Recently, YouTube CEO Susan Wojcicki told a group of women in the high-tech industry that they needed to get behind the idea of mandatory classes in computer science in public schools, especially for girls and minorities. She complained that girls are being left behind when it comes to becoming computer literate and computer proficient. In today's letter, Google, Facebook, and Microsoft informed top education legislators in the House and Senate that in addition to requiring students to take computer science classes, the federal government should supply states with necessary resources to improve school programs in science, technology, engineering, and mathematics. Along this line, Facebook has launched Tech Prep, a highly publicized initiative to attract more minorities and women into studying computer coding in school. At the same time, tech companies insist that the government should continue supporting their efforts to bring in foreign workers in order to make up for the domestic shortage of programmers and technicians. In this request, the tech companies say that the federal government is responsible for forcing them to go outside the country to hire.
The nation's midsection is beginning to register pain. says the New York Times. A chill in economic activity is being felt from the Gulf of Mexico to the Canadian border because prices of commodities are sinking. The reason, according to the Times, is that demand for U.S.-produced commodities from China and other nations has slowed to a trickle. Prices are falling for crude oil, iron ore, and agricultural crops like corn and soybeans, reminding economists of the dot-com collapse in 2000 and the bursting of the housing bubble that brought on the recent Great Recession. Investors and bankers, worried about the direction things are taking, are tightening up on capital. Their fear is based on announcements from companies like Caterpillar, which announced in late September that falling overseas demand for its bulldozers and excavators could end in the layoff of up to 10,000 workers. Alcoa and DuPont are also threatening job cuts. The Agriculture Department forecasts that farm income, adjusted for inflation, will fall 54% from where it was 2 years ago. The price of corn has dropped by half from 3 years ago. For some Americans, however, the commodities glut has been a blessing. Chicken and milk are cheaper, as are coffee and other commodities from abroad. Airlines are also happy with the decrease in the price of jet fuel, which has allowed them to buy new planes and offer more affordable flights.
President Obama's Clean Power Plan, designed to reduce greenhouse gas emissions, has come under legal attack from coal-producing states backed by fossil fuel industry groups. The 24 states plan to file lawsuits with the U.S. Court of Appeals, saying that the plan is unlawful and will eliminate coal mining jobs while driving up the cost of electricity. The Obama administration and environmental groups insist that the only way to curb climate change is to cut carbon emissions. They say that the plan spurs the creation of new energy, clean energy jobs. The new rules require states to cut carbon emissions by 30% by 2030. Each state has a customized target and is responsible for drawing up an effective plan to meet its goal. The overall intent of the plan is to quickly close down the sale of high-carbon fuels to power plants. The Sierra Club has vowed to defeat the new lawsuit by the fossil fuel industry. They say that the Clean Power Plan is based on a law passed by Congress, upheld by the Supreme Court, and demanded by the American people.
Mexican authorities have already declared a state of emergency as Mexico's west coast prepares to be hit by winds up to 200 miles per hour. Category 5 Hurricane Patricia was expected to make landfall this afternoon, bringing with it ocean waves up to 40 feet high. Any or all of the states of Nayarit, Jalisco, Colima, Michoacán, and Guerrero may be hit. In addition, the tourist resorts of Manzanillo and Puerto Vallarta may undergo torrential rains. The Mexican army is moving as many residents as possible into shelters, and some 15,000 tourists have been evacuated from the state of Nayarit to the city of Guadalajara, some 120 miles inland. Mexican President Enrique Peña Nieto warned the nation via Twitter that never in Mexico's history has there been a hurricane this strong. Media outlets urge the public to seek shelter and not to underestimate the strength of the storm. To the north, in Texas, moisture from monster Hurricane Patricia is combining with a storm system coming from the west, flooding streets in Dallas and Austin. The National Weather Service, concerned there may be torrential downpours through the weekend, has placed almost the entire state under a flood watch.
A suicide bomber killed at least 18 people and wounded 35 in the city of Jacobabad in southern Pakistan today during a Shia religious procession. The regional police chief said the attacker hit the procession of families commemorating the Muslim holiday of Ashura. Eight children aged 8 to 15 were among the dead, and many of the wounded are in critical condition. The attack was the second in 2 days to hit the commemoration surrounding Ashura. No one immediately took responsibility, but suspicion has fallen on the Sunni Muslim militant group Lashkar-e-Jahangir, who claimed responsibility for Thursday's attacks. Those attacks killed at least 10 people in a Shia mosque. Pakistani authorities have heightened their security to protect Ashura events by suspending mobile services, sealing off procession routes, and having paramilitary groups escort the procession.
One U.S. military member was killed yesterday during a U.S. rescue mission of 70 hostages held within an Islamic State stronghold in northern Iraq. The commando marks the first American combat death in Iraq since 2011. He was shot within the compound of Hawija and flown to Erbil, where he died. The threat of execution was imminent, according to a U.S. official. The U.S. Special Operations Troops and the Kurdish and Iraqi forces that worked on the mission had to move fast to rescue the hostages, which included local residents, more than 20 members of the Iraqi security forces, and several ISIS fighters accused of spying. More than 20 ISIS fighters were killed and 6 were captured, according to statements from the Kurdistan Regional Government. The firefight represents the first time U.S. forces stepped into combat against ISIS in Iraq, one U.S. official said.
In Sweden today, 2 students and a teaching assistant were killed when a white supremacist wielding a sword attacked students at a school for immigrants. The teaching assistant, Levin Eskandar, 20, shouted at children to run before he ran toward the killer to try to take him down. He was killed, but the killer was also stopped and police took him into custody. The man who killed the teenagers is Anton Lunden Pettersson, 21. He's affiliated with a number of white supremacist and neo-Nazi groups. He arrived at the school dressed as Darth Vader. He even posed with some students before he began stabbing them with his sword. He targeted his victims based on skin color and tried to kill the darkest-skinned students he could find. The 2 students killed in the attack were identified as Ahmed Hassan, 15, who had fled violence in Libya with his parents. The other victim was a Syrian refugee whose name has not yet been made public.
You're listening to the KABU Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we